everybody. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for 1 hour. And we don't usually do two specials in a row, but last week was our Nightmare on Elm Street special, and this week both of our movies are directed by George A. Romero of the famous Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead trilogy. And our good movie is actually the third part of that trilogy. Well, it's not a trilogy anymore, but we'll get to that. Day of the Dead, 1985. And our bad movie is The Dark Half, which he directed in 90, I think, came out in 93. I noticed the copyright on the film was 92. And you know, Romero had, all through the 80s, he'd been making a movie every couple of years, but basically after Day of the Dead in 85, his movies kind of started getting a little cheesier and a little, people started caring a little bit less each time. And this was his last movie before a 7-year leave from film. He came back in 2000 to direct the movie Bruiser, and then he was gone for another 5 years before he directed another zombie movie, and that was Land of the Dead in 2005. Anyways, The Dark Half is a Stephen King adaptation, and it was a bestseller in 1988, apparently. I don't know why that's funny.
Just the way you say it, like, you only sort of believe it because you read it on Wikipedia.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why I say apparently. But, you know, I mean, this was a time, I mean, Stephen King adaptations, they're probably, you know, probably the majority of them were made in the mid to late 80s. So early 90s, you're kind of starting to, the Stephen King movie adaptation craze is starting to die down. But for Romero, I'm sure the way he did this movie was he got offered it because he and Stephen King collaborated on the much-beloved Creepshow in 1982, for which King wrote the screenplay and Romero adapted, and people really enjoy that movie and how it takes this this gaudy comic book cinematography to create the feel of an EC comic, and the stories written by King are very kind of EC horror comics-ish. And this, The Dark Half couldn't really be more different than that. I mean, it's, you know, I don't think it's a bad movie because of Romero. It's, you know, it's well directed. It, you know, art-wise, it hangs together. The acting is kind of suspect, and I suspect we'll be talking about that with Day of the Dead, and that directing actors isn't his strongest suit, but you know, it actually has the same editor and production designer as Day of the Dead, I noticed. And filmmaking-wise, it's fine. Even the few gory special effects that there are really damn good. The problem really rests with King, because this is like, I mean, I'm going to feel like we're talking about Oliver Stone's The Hand again, because this is like this age-old story of, you know, a creative person with a split personality, and the split personality is sort of created by the creative person's creative impetus. And you could do this story with a you could do this story with a painter or a musician or anything, really. But in this case, it's a writer, because Stephen King, as far back as The Shining, at least, he loves to create stories about writers and have writers be the main characters, even when it doesn't particularly matter. Like in It, like one of the main characters is a horror writer. Like, wow, gee, duh, you know, smack your head. Like, I wonder how he researched that character. And it's particularly annoying in The Dark Half, and because, well, first of all, the movie's 2 hours, and it like teases you with this premise that you already know what it's going to be like in the first 5 minutes, when in a flashback we see the main character as a kid having these schizophrenic migraines, and that he's going to be a writer. But like, it really drags it out, like you've never seen this plot before. And like, I don't care who you are, when you start watching The Dark Half, like, you've seen this plot a million times before. Oh, but what's so annoying about Stephen King's version of it is that, like, he based, like, the first act of the movie is actually the most interesting because it's about this author with a pseudonym who publishes books under a pseudonym, and someone found out and they're going to bribe him, or they're going to blackmail him over it. And this actually happened to King, and supposedly this is someone threatened to expose his Richard Bachman alias, and supposedly that experience of attempted blackmail inspired him to write the Dark Half novel, and that's fine, whatever, but, like, when you get right down to it, the story is really just, like, Stephen King's fan fiction about himself. Like, he was sitting around, it's like, what's my next book going to be about? And I guess he had, you know, going back to last week's episode, like, a Wes Craven moment where he was like, gee, what if one of my characters became real and came after me? And that's really all that happens in The Dark Half. The author's character, well, except it's a little trickier than that, but, like, kind of to no point. Like, it's not that the character's creation has suddenly come into reality and is murdering those close to him. The person that's suddenly come into existence is supposed to be his pseudonym self, and that's, of course, played by the same actor, Timothy Hutton, with slicked back hair to let you know that he's evil. And it's just incredibly boring, and that's why this movie's bad. It's really boring, and it's like the story is only interesting to Stephen King and George Romero, I guess, or maybe he just took the job because he needed it. But either way, it's really tedious.
Yeah, and we didn't. Okay, so one of the things that I enjoyed just so much about it was that okay, so it's his fictional, it's his pseudonym come to life.
Right.
But it also ends up being his twin. But it's an evil spirit that he wills into existence that because of where they place the fake gravestone, inhabits the partial remains of his tumorous unborn twin.
Yeah, which is revealed in a totally awesome gore shot where at the beginning of the movie where his brain is opened up and there's a blinking eyeball inside.
Which I kind of remember from the trailer, but that couldn't have been in the trailer, right? I mean, that would have been too...
If it was, that's a pretty hideous thing to put in the trailer.
Because, I mean, it's pretty scary, you know? I mean, it's scary.
Yeah, and totally misleading, because there's nothing that cool in the rest of the movie.
It also, I mean, almost more interesting would be how that worked, that you could have a tumor that size that would not totally...
kill someone if it were growing in their brain.
Right, I mean, he'd be in
well,
some
there's
trouble.
A lot of... Well, you know, I mean, it is a magic spirit that brings this fictional person to life, so... I guess you can stretch your imagination a little bit for a blinking eye in the brain.
Well, I think the stretching of the imagination brings the Stephen King adaptation into question. Because, okay, so, like you said, this is supposedly was one of the bestsellers of 88 or 89, and
yeah,
second best-selling book. And so what's always amused me about King is that his books sell so much and nobody goes to see his freaking movies.
Yeah, but for almost like 20 years they just kept making them, just grinding them out.
Well, I mean, yeah, and so, but even since so famously he hates the Shining adaptation, and I personally have always said that I think the Shining is Kubrick's practical joke on critics and audiences and that kind of thing. But I mean, Carrie was a reasonable hit, right?
Right.
The Dead Zone was a respectable production. Christine, right?
Yeah, from about Carrie to 83, in which you had both Christine and Cujo. Stephen King adaptations actually got, like, good directors behind them. Like, you had Toby Hooper doing Salem Slot for TV and stuff. And then about 84, Dino De Laurentiis just scooped up the rights to a whole bunch of his stuff, and then they really started getting ground out. And then 2 years later, you had Maximum Overdrive directed for Dino De Laurentiis by Stephen King himself. So Stephen King on film, that it's been a spotty history at best.
And then The Running Man, of course, was a Bachman adaptation. But yeah. Anyway, and then by Pet Sematary, they were a punchline. It was a joke. No, Graveyard Shift, you know.
That's a good one, with the giant rats.
And then the TV movies started getting more respect because of It. You know, was a very big deal. Two nights, three nights, whatever.
It's not a bad TV movie either, for what it is.
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, whatever.
But yeah, I mean, like, then going, I mean, yeah, you kept seeing, like, TV, big TV, you know, multi-night network TV events and cable TV events and stuff.
And
like a four-hour, two-part Langoliers movie.
Right, the Tommyknockers, very long Tommyknockers. But then, you know, Lawnmower
Man. Needful Things, which was another, like, four-hour movie spread out a bunch of nights on TV.
No, it wasn't. Needful Things is actually a sequel to The Dark Half. I've always wanted to see it.
Well, it's not a direct sequel, but it does have...
The same...
It does have the same sheriff character who in this one is played by Michael Rooker, and then in Needful Things is played by Ed Harris.
But then Sleepwalkers, I mean, that's just a joke. I mean, that was like Cat People for the 90s or something. But Misery started this whole second thing that maybe you could do the respectable Stephen King.
Right, in 1990. Yeah, and then there were some... And then occasionally you'd have respectable Stephen King movies, but they wouldn't be horror movies. Like, you know, probably Shawshank Redemption being the best example.
Dolores Claiborne.
And Dolores Claiborne, yeah, for sure.
And then that sort of fizzled out, too. By the time they made The Green Mile, nobody went to go see it, which I just find
shocking. Apt Pupil didn't do so well, either.
Oh, yeah, that was his. Oh.
People didn't want to see Ian McKellen train Brad Renfro to be a young Nazi or whatever.
I'm sorry, wait, he wrote Hearts in Atlantis? That feel-good or whatever, hopeful...
Hey, man, he's got range, okay? He's not just, like, a horror guy.
No,
Stephen King.
I'm sorry. Wow. And now it's to the point where I can't even figure it out. I'm looking at the filmography, and it's just like, I can't figure all this out. There are, like, 90 movies since 2000 because of direct-to-video.
Yeah, but getting back to The Dark Half, I mean, one of the annoying things I found about The Dark Half, because I'd never seen it before, was like how much they try to put the Stephen King brand imprint on it. Like, it, you know, there's references to Castle Rock, which is this fictitious town that he features in a bunch of his stories, and it's in New England. Their New England accents drive me up the wall, but I guess Stephen King loves them, obviously.
Now, I think the Castle Rock stuff, I think he does that in the books.
He does, but, okay. I mean, when you include it into the movie, it's really trying to emphasize the Stephen King franchise name, and it's like, oh, yeah, if it's in New England and it's horror, you know you're watching Stephen King. It's a sign of quality. No, really, because what else, you know, when all these Stephen King movies are coming out, what else are they going to try to do? You know, they were trying to prevent what ended up happening, which was, you know, based on the novel by Stephen King becoming a punchline.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
They wanted it to have the prestige of, you know, John Grisham adaptations and stuff.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, The Dark Half is kind of like, you can see that there is the potential for it being a little bit more Misery-like, because it doesn't necessarily have to be as lame as it is. I mean, because
you know, something, it's funny that he wrote The Dark Half before Misery, and yet the Misery movie came out before the Dark Half movie, and Misery probably really cemented the idea for King and people who produce these movies that, you know, Stephen King's self-reflexive stories about writers being tormented by their work in one form or another is a surefire hit.
Well, his writer is such a... I mean, I know he's written a book about writing, and I know it's very positive. I know On Writing is a very inspirational, you know, look at his career and just writing in general. But I mean, this movie starts with the character sitting around writing, and oh, if he doesn't just grow up to write a bunch of great books and then make a bunch of money off of the crappy books he writes. And
yeah, and it's like, if the author is, if this character is a stand-in for Stephen King, then what does it say that, like, you know, his creative dilemma is that people don't read his good books, but they'll read his crap if he publishes it under a different name? I mean, there's kind of a contempt for the public there, and it comes through in the character.
No, I'm not actually
like the public isn't even in this movie. It's like at no point do you even like get a scene where someone recognizes him. I mean, he's teaching like a college class at the beginning of the movie, but it's not even full, you know. And then the guy who comes up for his autograph is the guy who's gonna try to blackmail him.
Yeah, and the Richard Bachman thing, it's... I'm not really all that aware. I mean, The Stand was early. Carrie came out early, so he would have been... King would have been published at this. He would have had, you know, the Hollywood money with Carrie and stuff. I mean, that's the crazy thing. I mean, I think the last time I did the math, King gets paid something like a quarter a word. So, I mean, like, the guy is just incredibly... well off from his writing, and I'm not sure why he would have even done this, and so...
Oh, well, supposedly, I mean, you know, he decided that he was so successful that he could afford to do an experiment and see how well some of his books might sell if he didn't put his own name on them.
Ah. Anyway, but in the movie...
Yeah.
The problem is that it's not a horror novelist that he's writing. The two characters, there's Thaddeus right. Beaumont, and I think he has a great middle name too, right? Does he? Does he have some sort of a
not on IMDb, unfortunately.
No, and it's just Thad Beaumont on Wikipedia too. But, you know...
Yeah, but he writes... They say that his, you know, serious books are like, I don't know, dramatic literature in one form or another, and George Stark novels are, I don't know, they seem to be about a serial killer. And that's the thing, is that like when his pseudonym comes to life, his pseudonym is actually acting out the MO of like one of his characters in his books. So it's...
On the other hand, I'm not sure that Alexis Machine is a tough guy name.
No, I don't. I wouldn't say.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, no. It sounds like a... It sounds
Alexis Machine. Alexis Machine sounds like a...
It sounds like a Baywatch girl from after Pamela Anderson left.
Yeah, I guess so. The Alexis part, definitely.
Yeah. So, but well, I mean, that's the thing is, I think the George, and we're talking about this because we don't actually know. I think the George Stark character is supposed to be the writer. That he's supposed to be a psychopath who lives down in Mississippi. And then. Don't you think? Yeah, so...
Well, I mean, but George, the pseudonym... All I was saying was that the pseudonym is acting out, like, what the books... What, I guess, characters do in the books that George Stark, the pseudonym, writes, which is, you know, bloody
right.
murder.
And so, yeah, and he's got a razor blade, and he runs around with it all the time, and the
yep.
makeup is really funny, because before he starts falling apart at the end, and has
yep.
to be in... has sort of like welts and tumors and stuff. He's it's Timothy Hutton with greasy hair and hold on, the forehead makeup. It's like he's got a Botoxed forehead, and that's how and weird eyebrows, and that's his bad guy makeup.
Yeah, and you know what's ridiculous is like there isn't a single scene in this 2-hour movie where someone recognizes him and goes like, "Hey, Thad, how's it going? Ah, why are you murdering me?" You know, like what are you doing, Thad? You know, like. Isn't that one of the first scenes that you write in a story like this? Because it is Tim Hutton, so you know. But everybody seems to think he's someone else, which really destroys some opportunities for scary scenes.
Well, that's kind of the thing, is there aren't any scary scenes. The only way this movie ever gets a scare is by putting children in danger at the end. I mean, really?
Well, I would say that and like a few. Well, the few effects shots that there are, and one of them is, you know, the brain thing that we mentioned at the beginning, but also like this weird dream sequence Tim Hutton has where he sees his wife with like plaster skin and she breaks apart and there's a skeleton underneath, and that's just scary because the effect is good looking.
The effects at the end when the bad guy's getting pulled apart by the birds, that's pretty cool.
Oh yeah, that's cool. Not scary, but.
It's cool looking. Yeah, I mean, it's gross. But yeah, the wife's played by Amy Madigan, and she would have been coming off of Field of Dreams at this point, and so I'm sure they cast her as just a sturdy wife character. But she's clearly older than Timothy Hutton, and she's 10 years older than him. And it makes him... I mean, the guy's career... He's still the youngest person I think ever to win Best Supporting Actor. Best Supporting Actress Anna Paquin won when she was like 11 or whatever, but I think he might still be the best youngest supporting actor award at 20. And so his whole career has been based off of being a baby-faced teenager. And so it's just like, it's so hard to see him. Like, I mean, I like Timothy Hutton, but it's taken him forever to come into his own as like a sort of, you know, just dude who, you know, does stuff. And in this, he's just kind of like, he's got this foppy hair, and it goes everywhere.
I don't know. I'm sure this is accidental or just a product of the times, but like, in this, whoever they cast as Bill Denbrough, the horror writer in Stephen King's It, like, he has the same kind of, like, wavy, girly hair as the dark half's Thad.
Yeah.
Something about Stephen King's... I don't remember who it was it was Carpenter. Yeah, John Carpenter once said that, like, all Stephen King stories are basically just Revenge of the Nerd. So his writer-protagonists in these movies always have... long silky hair, just like Johnny Depp in that movie Rear Window or Open Window or whatever from a few years ago. Secret Window, where yet another writer is terrorized by someone who's his biggest fan or thinks that he's stealing his work or whatever. I mean, it's like, wow, it's really dangerous to be a writer, you know?
The problem with it is that...
Timothy Hutton sure hopes that, you know, people won't mind the killing of this, you know, pseudonym, the symbol. Isn't this incredibly interesting for anyone who isn't Stephen King?
And there's absolutely no reaction to it, which is like the worst.
Right, that's what I was saying. We never see a single scene where, you know, he talks to a fan.
Because he's supposed to live in the middle of nowhere. I mean,
or even a scene where he's reading through fan letters, like reacting to his choice to, you know, to kill the pseudonym. I mean, In the Mouth of Madness has like more detail put into the ramifications of this author's popularity.
So the movie,
who was based on Stephen King, anyways, in that movie.
So the movie starts with the flashback, and then we flash forward to him and his wife doing something, and then he goes to work, or something like that, basically. And then he has this, but it's established that he's a writer, as an adult, with this family. And then he goes off to work, teaches his class, has this altercation with the guy over the pseudonym. And then...
It was one of the few interesting actors in the movie. I wish they'd kept him alive longer.
Yeah. Though I will say that I think Michael Rooker does a fine job in this. As the sheriff. Yeah.
So, yeah, he does that stuff. He has the altercation with the blackmailer.
Right. And then you find out that the whole reason that he has this wonderful life is not because he's teaching in a very nice... Oh, it wasn't
New
shot.
England, University.
It wasn't shot at University of Pittsburgh. It was shot at Washington and Jefferson, which is a private college in the Pittsburgh area. But anyway, so I mean, it's just this really nice auditorium where he's lecturing his class of 20 people, maybe 25, and it's just this ludicrous fiction writing class because I mean, you know, all the people look like they're about 30. I mean,
yeah.
It looks like a community extension course in some really nice place, like, you know, for yuppie housewives to do it. But anyway, so then you find out that the only reason that his family can afford anything is because of this Richard Stark, or is it George Stark? George Stark character.
Right.
And so that totally changes who the character is. It totally changes him from being somebody who's passionate about his writing to basically being someone who... You know, he's not passionate about his writing. He's passionate about the George Stark writing. His writing's he's totally indifferent to it because it doesn't make him any money or any success. And so it changes the character, and it's not like... I mean, the movie's long, right? I mean, it is...
Yeah, it's 2 hours.
It's 2 hours, but none of the time is spent at all on establishing Timothy Hutton as, like, you know...
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
yeah, exactly. It's just, like, all these... slow baby steps towards the revelations that you already know are coming, like, oh my god, his pseudonym came to life, and oh my god, his pseudonym is mad because, you know, he tried to kill him off, and like it treats all this stuff like we don't see it coming a million miles away.
So having a twin, and I know I already talked about this, him having the unborn twin, it has absolutely nothing to do with what happens, right?
Well, like, I guess the idea, like I think you already said, is that the reason the pseudonym has been made flesh and blood is because of the malevolent spirit of his
See, I don't
twin.
Think that, I don't think that is what it is. I don't think the twin was just dead tissue.
Well, what about the what about the flock of sparrows that showed up on the day that the tumor was removed and then came to peck him away?
Those are happy sparrows. I saw the end of the movie and they fly away into this cloud out of the never ending story. And it filled me with joy and happiness. It felt like it was the end of E.T.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, but whatever. The magical pseudonym made flesh is accompanied by magical sparrows, and it's...
But I don't think they do. That's. I mean, if you haven't seen this and you don't know what we're talking about, it's kind of hard to explain how crazy this is. That yes, there are sparrows around all the time because of the magical pseudonym, but maybe not. He can't see them, so I think they're totally unrelated to him and only related to the twin, because when they tore him out of the head, the sparrows came out of the head or whatever. And it's just perplexing. It's just.
Yeah. Then there's no scene where they, you know, sit you down and tell you exactly how stuff happened. It's basically just like three or four things that King threw into a pot of, like, you know, his pseudonym came to life and he had a baby brother and tumor in his head and, you know, flock of sparrows were there on the day that happened. And
that was a cool scene.
Yeah, no, actually it's I think most, like, the scenes of this herd of this flock of sparrows that shows up at some points symbolically, Romero just used a whole ton of real live birds. And then I think at the end, I mean, this was 92 93, there's some early CG birds in the crowd, but mostly it was just a whole lot of real birds, and those scenes do look really cool. They look like, well, you know, I guess he probably enjoyed doing some kind of homage to the birds, because that's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's... That was
He's a
cool.
good director. Like I said, the direction isn't the problem here.
No, and
just this totally boring story with boring actors. You can't possibly bring yourself to care about.
Yeah, and yeah. Even when they put the kids in danger, it's like, all I could wait for was the end when one of them turns the other one is like, you know.
And they're evil, yeah.
They're evil, right. And they don't even do that. And I guess
I know. Why are you gonna have twins in your movie, in a movie about an evil schizo split personality, if one of those little babies isn't going to, you know, have shifty eyes and zoom in on that at the end?
Well, I mean, I was reading the Wikipedia entry on the novel after I finished watching the movie.
Yeah.
And I guess the novel ends with the wife basically deciding that, you know, regardless of them coming through this okay, her husband's still a freaking psychopath for, you know, wanting to be like this guy. And so then in the, there's some further notes that, you know, in the other books that the sheriff is in, eventually you find out that the main character in this movie kills himself because his wife, you know, can't trust him.
Yeah,
it leads him to misery. But this movie just ends so happily. I mean, it's just like,
yeah, the bluebirds of happiness fly into the sunset, the blue sparrows.
But yeah, like I said, I mean, I like Michael Rooker fine. I thought, you know, he did an okay job doing his Michael Rooker thing before he started being a total twit with Mallrats. And Julie Harris was good as this insane professor friend of Timothy Hutton that had absolutely, you know, was the silliest character in a movie ever. Like, she's supposed to be like a witch doctor, and like a witch doctor of philosophy. I mean, it's just like,
yeah. But I was a little disappointed by Royal Dano's small role. I was looking forward to him. I enjoy him, but he was basically just a crusty old cemetery groundskeeper who could have been played by any crusty old coot.
Yeah. Pretty much all the smaller roles were like that. Except for the writer who had the ponytail.
Uh-huh.
I totally thought they were going to make a comment about the ponytail because he's a what magazine was he from? Time? Or Newsweek or something? People?
He's from one of them fancy New York magazines.
Yeah, and he dressed like a cowboy and had a ponytail and like he was bald. Yeah. And like, it's just
if you recall when George Stark is murdering him, he does cut off his ponytail.
He does, yes. And of course this was one of the Orion movies that got lost.
Along with RoboCop 3.
Along with RoboCop 3, and I don't know, apparently Tim Hutton quit once and was a jerk to George Romero. But I can't imagine anybody on this movie really being happy with anybody else. Like, really? Yeah.
Maybe the babies were happy working with each other.
Yeah, the two girls. That's the first time I've ever seen a girl play a boy, I guess. I don't know, that I can think of. Right?
That I can think of, too, but I'm not much for baby roles in movies.
Trivia, yeah, no. But, yeah, I mean, I remember the preview for this, and the idea sounds kind of cool, right? Mm-hmm. Like, your unborn twin comes back to life to freaking do stuff. The other thing is, it's never really implied that it might actually be Timothy Hutton the good guy killing everybody.
Yeah, that is odd now that you mention it. Yeah.
There's no suspicion of it, really. I mean,
yeah. That would have at least been like another thing to go to. Because like the setup for what's actually happening is so telegraphed that they should have tried to think of at least one thing to one possibility of what's going on to fake you out with as a red herring.
Yeah, but instead they he tells everybody what's going on. He like tells the cops. Oh, that was the other thing. Did you notice they never freaking arrested him?
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Okay.
Like, at the end of the first act, when George Stark has killed someone, Michael Rooker's like, well, they found your fingerprints at the scene of the crime. And then they don't arrest him, and then he's just, like, got a police escort with him. And it's like, when you're under suspicion for murder, that's not what happens. You don't get a police escort just so that there can be a cop nearby when the next murder happens and prove that you're innocent, you know? But that's what happens in the Dark Half.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Pretty triflesome. Pretty pointless. No wonder he took a 7-year hiatus from movies after this one.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really like a 9-year hiatus if you think about it.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the delay. Yeah, no, it's not a...
It's not terrible, but it has like nothing to recommend to it.
I'm trying to think if anything about it is memorable.
I don't think so. I think the thing I'm going to take away from this movie is a blinking eyeball and a brain.
Yeah, but isn't that like on the cover of some DVD release now or something? I think I can't take that away from it because they would have had to take out half of his brain. And so he would be brain dead. But besides, the birds. I mean, the shot at the end with the birds flying away. I mean, that's like the thing that I find so amusing about Stephen King sometimes is that he always feels the need to explain stuff to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And even when he shouldn't, you know?
Yeah.
Like in the Dark Half, maybe if he hadn't explained that this was an evil spirit and had scene after scene of them talking about that and it just been some, you know, strange, you know, whatever, uncanny thing happened, but
yeah,
he has these like weirdly magical happy things, like the birds
yeah.
flying off into the freaking like sky. It's like
yeah.
Cocoon. It's like Cocoon. The spaceship from Cocoon came back, let the sparrows out, they killed the bad guy, and then they went back up to space with Steve Guttenberg.
I was kind of disgusted when I found out that the original ending of the Shining novel was happy and that Danny's imaginary friend Tony was the voice of his future self guiding him. And then, like, the last scene is, like, he's having his high school graduation and Dick Halloran is there. and the ghost of his dad, who was trying to murder him, is, like, looking on at his son peacefully and everybody's happy.
Seriously?
Yeah, for real.
Wow.
And it's also like when you're reading Stephen King's It, and at first it's just about this monster that feeds on fear and dresses up like a clown, and that's uncanny and scary, and then you keep reading and reading and reading and reading because it's so long, and then you get to the point where it's like, huh, actually It is some kind of Lovecraftian old god, and there's another old god who's good and who takes the form of a giant turtle, and they've been at war. And now the spirit of the turtle is going to help the kids fight it. Well, that's fantastical.
Yeah,
fantastical and no longer scary.
It turns into a monster movie. It turns into Fantastic Island. You know, it's the or Mysterious Island. It's the crab monster. Only, you know, it used to be Tim Curry. And yeah, this is way too literal. It's way but not in any way that, you know, we can't sit here and talk for 5 minutes about it. It makes no sense. And it's just
The Dark Half. Probably the only thing I'll ever remember about the Dark Half is that I remember, like, back in the fourth or fifth grade or something, like, some, you know, we were doing book reports, and some kid did his book report on the Dark Half, and the teacher was so impressed, and she was like, oh, isn't it amazing that he read something as long as the Dark Half? Like, and looking back on that, I'm like, yeah, you know, Stephen King books are pretty long on average, but maybe it would have been more impressive if he read something good.
That's, you know... George Stark wouldn't like to hear you say that. Okay.
Is that about do it for the dark half?
Yeah, and so I was actually hoping we could somehow segue into Day of the Dead by there being a Stephen King book in Day of the Dead, but...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, that book is Salem's Lot.
Yes.
Which Toby Hooper directed for TV. It doesn't show up until sort of more halfway or more through the movie, though. But, yeah, well... Whatever, King and Romero are pals. That's all that means.
And so, 6 years earlier, or 8 years earlier, Romero did Day of the Dead.
Mm-hmm. And which was, it came out within a very short time period of Return of the Living Dead. And which we've reviewed on this podcast, and Return of the Living Dead probably couldn't be any more different than Day of the Dead, and Return cleaned Day's clock, and it was that must have been pretty hard for Romero seeing an unofficial sequel with the phrase Living Dead in it being the zombie hit of the year, and not his highly anticipated conclusion of the trilogy. As it was at the time, and as it was for the next 20 years, actually. And a lot of people, a lot of people don't like this movie, and I can totally acknowledge the flaws that it has, and of course it has some serious flaws, but I think its positive aspects more than make up for its flaws, and. The reason I wasn't even able to appreciate some of its more unique and impressive things was, I was like most people when I saw Day of the Dead on video. It was pretty shortly after I had seen Dawn of the Dead for the first time, and I was sort of, you know, Dawn of the Dead is like such a fun rock'em sock'em adventure movie with zombies and a great action movie as well. That you're sort of hoping for the same thing again with Day, and Day just. Isn't that at all? It has more in common with the original Night of the Living Dead, and people just sort of wanted, you know, as big and epic as Dawn of the Dead was compared to Night of the Living Dead, people wanted Day of the Dead to be even more so. And the only way in which it's even more so than Dawn of the Dead is in the gore effects by Tom Savini, which I think are... This movie might be his best when you just think about the variety of effects and makeup in it and how it all looks so good. Except for Gregory Nicotero's severed head, but that's just one thing amongst, I mean, you know, dozens and dozens of great effects. So, yeah, so I've come around to this movie. I didn't like it when I first saw it, but I've come around to it on repeat viewings, and this was the first time that you'd seen it, right?
It is. I mean, I'd heard of it for years. Saw Dawn of the Dead, somehow I waited on Day of the Dead at that point, and then I got to, you know, sort of the, no pun intended, dawn of the DVD era. So, you know, it became waiting for Day of the Dead to come out in a acceptable release to watch it and that sort of thing. So, yeah, so now this is the first time I've seen it, and, I like almost all of it.
I remember last week you said that your problems with New Nightmare were basically superficial, like certain actors and stuff, and like the music. I think my problems with Day of the Dead are superficial. Like there's some actors I don't think can act, and there's some characters who are really poorly written, but those are superficial problems. It where it counts, it
yeah.
succeeds.
And there's just some really nasty stuff in it. I mean, especially when you think about how it only takes place over 3 days.
Something like that.
I mean, it probably takes place over longer, but it certainly doesn't feel like that because they're in this isolated place, and I just read that, you know, Romero's budget for this got totally chopped up. And so it is sort of strange to see after he expands with Dawn of the Dead to sort of constrict down with Day of the Dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his original ideas for Day of the Dead were sort of to make it, you know, an even bigger epic than Dawn, but he had the choice of doing that and having to deliver an R movie or doing a movie on a low budget with, you know, the goriest Tom Savini effects that Tom Savini could think of, and obviously he opted for the latter. And that's, you know, it's what kind of what makes it. But I mean, yeah, tonally, it's so. That's the other thing too, is that it's not just not an action movie. It's this really bleak, nihilistic thing about how, you know, in the last days of humanity, you know, struggling to survive against the zombies, they're just, you know, humanity is just going to you know, tear itself apart, even when it's down to just a few survivors. Because most of this movie is people yelling at each other.
Yeah, it's people yelling at each other, and it's
It sort of reminds me of like a Roger Corman movie or something. I mean, in a good way, and as complimentary as I can be about that. Or let's just say any low budget sci-fi movie where it's like it is mostly just actors standing around and talking to each other, but because of the limited budget, they're sort of standing around talking to each other about, you know, all this fantastic stuff that's happening, like, you know, the whole world has been taken over by zombies, and, you know, even though it's just actors standing around talking to each other, it's sort of, you know, I don't know, it's a little bit like watching a play. Like, you could adapt Day of the Dead into a play without too much difficulty.
Yeah,
it's a different kind of sci-fi sort. It's like reading, it's like a science fiction story or something. Like, there's science fiction stories that, you know, take place on Mars or something, or in some ice, you know, a space station, or just some place where humanity is isolated from some kind of alien threat, and there's claustrophobia, and it's not the kind of like time-sensitive, panicked, stronghold situation that, like, the characters in Night of the Living Dead are in, for instance, where it's just some strangers run into a farmhouse and they're under constant siege, basically. Day of the Dead is, they're in this place that's completely fortified from zombies underground, but they're stuck there with each other, and so nobody's in a hurry, but, well, except for the army guys, and... Yeah, but, I mean, there is... It's just so bleak. It's sort of like... I think it's like Romero doing with the story what no one expected him to do, which is to take the idea of zombies taking over the world, like, to its sort of logical endpoint, where it's like, yeah, at some point, there's just no hope left at all, and zombies have completely taken over, and there's nothing you can do about it.
And so you're left with these characters. There's no... You like some of the characters, and so you don't want them to die, obviously, but the zombies aren't even the threat. I mean, that's kind of the thing, is that...
Right.
You know, Romero has gotten a lot more... what's the word we should use? Obvious with his political commentary.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
Here, it would just be that... You basically do not want to put a bunch of military guys around without a chain of command around a bunch of civilians. That's the moral of this story.
Yeah.
And only one woman. I mean, that's the moral. And a black guy.
And, yeah, especially if, you know, there's ethnic minorities amongst the non-soldiers, because then the soldiers are going to hate them even more for being ethnic minorities.
That is basically the moral of the story here, and as far as he takes that. And so you're just kind of sitting around waiting for terrible, terrible things to happen.
It's like, you know at some point the zombies are going to get in there. some of these military guys are going to get their comeuppance via zombies eventually. So you're just sort of, you know, hating them up until that point throughout most of the movie. And then, of course, each of them do have really spectacular, gory deaths, and it's pretty satisfying.
Yeah, and
sort of like the sci-fi movie. I mean, if I could just elaborate that on a little bit, I think it's maybe what makes me think of it as like a Roger Corman sci-fi movie with scientists standing around and talking to each other are the great scenes with Dr. Logan, nicknamed Frankenstein, who's conducting experiments on zombies and is just sort of a jabbermouth, and he's just like spouting off all this research that he's discovered about the zombies. And you know, we talk. I think I said the same thing about Return of the Living Dead, which came out the same year, which was, I mean, in Return of the Living Dead, in sort of a you had to be there thing, even though I saw both these movies, you know, at least 5 years after they came out on video, but before, say, Resident Evil, the first movie, came out, which is that, like, in Return of the Living Dead, it's more shocking to hear characters in a zombie movie reference Night of the Living Dead and for zombies to run and talk. That was a unique idea for the time, and even for a few years following. Day of the Dead, it's almost like you kind of had to be there or at least seen this movie a little before, I don't know, Zombieland at the very least, but really I'm thinking all the way back to Shaun of the Dead or something. I think it helps to enjoy Day of the Dead more to have seen it when zombies were still, like, objects of fear and not just like cannon fodder for Woody Harrelson to get decapitate or whatever, where zombies weren't just a pop cultural joke where it's like, how, you know, how many ways can you think of to kill a zombie? Which, I mean, and that's sort of like all the zombie movies that have come out in the last 10 years have just been about like how funny it is that zombies are these slow-moving human beings who are easy to kill. And in that sense, it's like the movie going public has become the, you know, the redneck militias that Romero was making fun of in the original movies, where we're just, like, you know, getting our rocks off killing zombies in creative ways because we're bloodthirsty and they're formerly people and we're just enjoying killing people by osmosis when you get right down to it. So my point was, in Day of the Dead, it's like when the zombies do get in at the end, it's a great like oh shit moment. But I think watching it now, I feel like it was even more so when you were still able to think of zombies as something to be scared of and something to be unsettled by if you watch, you know, the original Night of the Living Dead or something.
Yeah, and they do.
They've lost their threat. It would be like trying to be seriously scared of a vampire story now, or something, to use a weak analogy.
Yeah, and I mean, you just have to look at the Resident Evil movies that have to make super zombies just to make them scary, basically. But yeah, I mean, in this one, the threat of the zombie attack is still very strong, and I think it's because it is an isolated group, and he does establish it, and I can't, you know, name all the characters in the movie and probably couldn't have while watching it, but I certainly could recognize them, and even if they were complete jerks and all that, but they're still familiar and they're still people, and so the scenes, there really aren't very many big zombie scenes except at the beginning and the end.
Mm-hmm.
Except throughout, there's this corral of zombies that they're testing. And,
yeah, the only real zombie scenes are the Dr. Logan scenes, which lead to the Dr. Logan and Bub scenes. Bub being... Oh, that was another thing, too, is that, like, in 85, you know, zombies hadn't talked yet, and here you had Day of the Dead and Return of the Living Dead, where zombies are talking, and they handle it in two completely different ways, and... In Day of the Dead, it's like, oh my God, we finally hear a zombie talk. You know, does this mean that zombies aren't the mindless, scary, you know, flesh-eating machines that we think of them as? Do they still have some semblance of intelligence or something? And then Return of the Living Dead is all send more cops. You know. You know, just maybe sort of like this is the beginning of Romero. I mean, at least in the subsequent zombie movies that he would make 20 years later, this movie indicates the beginning of Romero's sort of loss of subtlety in his social or political commentary, and just the, you know, the military guys are all complete bastards.
Some of them could have been nice, but I think they get killed.
This was also the beginning of Romero's obvious sympathy for zombies, preference for zombies over people, because it's a zombie, it's Bub the intelligent zombie, who basically gets the big dramatic arc of the movie. No one else really has an arc, but Bub the zombie learns to be intelligent. He loses his father figure, the doctor, who taught him to be intelligent, and then he takes his revenge and he gets to kill the bad guy at the end, and then kind of walk off into the sunset too. And of course, I love that's, you know, that's just part of how great the ending of the movie is. The scene where he's stalking the bad guy down the halls and shooting at him and leading him to that corridor full of zombies.
Yeah.
Speaking of that sequence and the way the head bad guy gets ripped apart at the end, I don't remember Shaun of the Dead too well, but do you remember, I mean, they parodied that death, right? With the guy getting ripped in two?
I think so. I think that's the scene everybody told me to be careful watching,
right,
or something.
Right,
and
right,
I was,
the one,
yeah,
people remarked about being the goriest. Yeah.
And I was totally not. I'm like, it's a zombie movie. Of course you're going to have that happen. Yeah, I think that's there. The problem is that... Okay, so the movie opens with a helicopter. Very much like Dawn of the Dead. Closes. And opens. I think it opens with a helicopter and closes with a helicopter too, right?
Yeah, it's got a lot of helicopter stuff.
A lot of helicopter stuff. So, I mean, that's a little bit of connection. And then you have the hunt for more survivors. And that's never really clearly explained. Because they're in Florida. And there are more places in Florida, but they only seem to go do this one search.
Yeah, they say they've been 100 miles...
every direction.
Yeah, and from Sarasota to the whatever.
So, I mean, that's kind of the thing. I mean, Romero plays loose with the... how the world's responding to this overall, which is fine. But the problem is that your main character... I think she's a doctor. Right, she's a scientist.
Yeah, she's a scientist, although we see, like, one scene of her spinning test tubes around. We don't really get to see what she even does, except for take shit from everybody.
And the first, in the first act, she's basically, it's more about her dating one of the soldiers.
Yeah, Miguel.
Mm-hmm. But he's a complete jerk.
Right.
Regardless of his exhaustion.
And the other soldiers don't like him because he's a spick. Because, I don't know, soldiers are racist even to other soldiers who happen to be Hispanic.
Yeah, and,
they're so racist they call the black guy a jungle bunny, which I don't even know if people were still using that epithet in 1985. Anyways,
yeah, I mean, that scene, too. I mean, actually...
it's a little forced.
It's a little forced, but actually, it's kind of effective because they never do it before then. They restrain
right.
themselves.
So, I mean, right.
Romero's obviously going for they're total bastards, and here's why. Because there's a problem with that, in that... okay, so Dr. Frankenstein, you find out that he's been killing soldiers... somehow.
Or at least feeding their remains to
it's
the zombies.
Never clear. Well, he couldn't have done that because it would have been infected flesh. Right? It's not exactly clear where those bodies came from. Just it's not clear why he apparently killed a living guy and substituted him for a zombie corpse. Because there's the scene where the major is being just his brain.
You know, I never thought about that. But yeah, it's sort of like if the dead major who was going to come back alive as a zombie, then he wouldn't have had his head shot. And it seems like, you know, certainly the army guys know that, you know, the first thing to do when someone gets bitten by a zombie or even dies of natural causes is to kill the brain.
So anyway, when they discover him, it's the girl and the... I thought he was like French-Canadian helicopter pilot.
He's supposed to be an Irishman.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because he's drinking all the time?
Oh, no, yeah, sorry. He's the radio technician.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's Irish? Okay.
Yeah, he's the Irish one, and the black pilot is Jamaican, yeah. So, yeah.
They've just discovered this terrible thing about the doctor. It's totally reasonable for the army guys to shoot him up. And I'm just kind of like, they're getting all upset about it. I'm like, what are you, insane? He's you know, training the... He's totally lost it. Didn't you notice his hair? His hair, Frankenstein's hair.
Yeah.
It shoots over to one side because you can tell he's crazy. And so,
And they found the tape recording of him talking to himself.
Yeah, his mother telling him he's doing a good job and stuff. And so it's like, I think they had to demonize them, the army guys, after that scene somehow. So they made them even more racist.
Yeah, and then they, like, shoot one of the other scientists in the head in the next scene.
Yeah, so it all starts to come apart there, and it's...
John Amplis, by the way, Martin from Romero's Martin.
Who got thanked in the end credits of The Dark Half.
Oh, I didn't notice.
Yeah, special thanks.
Huh. Well, yeah, so... Basically, this is a long way around to saying that Bub the Intelligent Zombie is easily the most likable character, and that's kind of the point. That's kind of the point. It's like Romero saying that, you know, humanity is just beyond all redemption, and what the new zombie world needs now is good zombie leaders like Bub. But yeah, you know, whatever. I think I always, you know, I never really noticed, what you were just saying, I never really thought about, never really noticed before, because I just felt like, you know, oh no, they shot one of the more interesting and fun characters to watch. Now the only good guys left are Lori Cardell and the Irishman and the black guy, who isn't even Jamaican, by the way, as it turns out. He was just putting on the accent. How cheesy is that? And then that's also Romero's stupid social consciousness of, like, well, I guess every zombie movie I do has to have a strong black character in it. Whatever, though.
Yeah, I mean, those guys are likable. I mean, that's kind of... They're the relief of Day of the Dead.
They're likable enough, yeah, but, I mean, I find them kind of annoying in comparison to, you know, maybe the more low-key, but... more active, shall we say, cast of Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, I mean, well...
Whose personalities aren't really distinguished, but they're always running around kicking ass, so they're more fun.
Yeah, I think the problem is that in Day of the Dead, you have to do the forced introduction to these guys, like, oh, I didn't know for the last, you know, 6 months you've had a trailer out here with a tropical setting in the back and a bunch of booze. I had no idea. I'm just seeing it for the first time, like the audience.
Do you think they're gay?
Because they do
have that kind of domestic situation.
They're very
set
domestic.
Up.
They never go after the girl.
There's that white sweater that the Jamaican is wearing in that scene.
Yeah, that's true.
That white, like, white double knit sweater. Anyways.
Yeah. I did think it was interesting, though, when Sergeant Private Steele, the really, really jerky army guy besides Rhodes, Rhodes' performance is, the guy who plays Rhodes, Joseph Pilato, the performance is sort of amazing in a way that, like...
it really is, because, like, it starts at 10 and it stays there.
Yeah, I mean, the guy's
through the entire movie, and, yeah, I'd be... it's hard to think of other performances that can only go from intense to slightly less intense through the whole movie. But and he's a major character, you know.
Yeah. Steele had this buddy that worked the gate of the corral with him.
Yeah,
and the guy gets killed, and there's no scene of Steele going, "Rickles died."
Yeah, no, I hate Rickles. Anyways, he's one of the guys who can't act, who really can't act. And when he's laughing and, you know, being a mm-hmm. being a jerk with his army buddies, it's really apparent that he can't act. He just giggles like a moron mostly.
Well, I mean,
even up until getting his forehead broken open, which is so wonderfully gross and horrifying. It's kind of like the movie makes up for not having too much zombie action the way Dawn of the Dead did, just by having like the few deaths at the end by zombie be these horrifying set pieces.
Yeah, and
lots
when it
hit.
Does come out, it's when they do finally invade, it just is this flood of it. It's
yeah. What did you think of the music?
I liked it.
Yeah, it's really like
it's kind of strange.
It has themes. It has like the zombies have their own theme, and the military guys have their own theme, and Bub the Zombie has his own theme, and John Harrison, who also did the music for Romero's Creep Show, I know he kind of like does variations on these different characters' themes throughout the movie, and that's something I enjoy on repeat viewings is sort of hearing all the thought that he obviously put into it. He really kind of makes it operatic or something with all the themes. So I also think it helps sell some scenes that wouldn't sort of work otherwise. Like I'm thinking of when Laurie Cardell and her two sidekicks are climbing up that missile silo ladder to escape at the very end, and you know, like a zombie grabs onto the black guy's leg and the Irishman shoots him and he says, "Come along, Johnny, we're counting on you to fly us to the promised land." And it's such a stupid line and everything, but the music in that scene is like really, like right when he says that, the music goes into, you know, the main Day of the Dead theme, and it's upbeat, and you just sort of feel the energy of the scene, even though the writing is so dumb.
Yeah, and the music also really helps with the dream sequences.
Yeah.
A lot of dream sequences. Three of them, I think. And
yeah, one of them being the end of the movie, which comes really abruptly. And then and then the credits close with this kind of marimba-laden, like, easy listening song. But also by John Harrison, but with vocals even.
Yeah, I mean the first one's freaky, and then yeah.
The second one is a rock and roll adventure with music by Goblin, and then and then Day of the Dead is yeah, well it's its own thing too, and you know I'll always put it over above Romero's subsequent zombie movies, which have just sort of been getting progressively worse.
Yeah, to the point now where they even really
it's not even
in the theater anymore.
Like no, more like limited. I think the one that just came out, Survival of the Dead, is probably only going to be in limited release. I mean, Diary of the Dead at least got into theaters like Land of the Dead did, but he's been putting out one since 05 every 2 years now, and they get each one gets worse reviews and is regarded a little less than the last one.
Now, Diary of the Dead was like a first person.
Oh, it was so bad. It was supposed it's entirely in first person video cameras, a la Blair Witch or the Spanish horror film Wreck, which was actually a good movie. But it's so bad because Romero did not like grow up using or watching handheld video cameras. And so he takes this filmmaker's approach to a first-person video camera gimmick, and it's the fakest thing ever. Because it's like these very filmically staged and well blocked, but supposedly spontaneous scenes happening from the point of view of handheld cameras. And it's like, if this were happening, why would someone be like standing so and so feet away and getting a nice medium shot of it instead of running? And it's not even a problem with the concept, because Spanish horror film Wreck is maybe the one like handheld camera horror movie where it's like it sort of is like a zombie movie, like in an apartment building, but like the characters holding the cameras never do anything that's you know, like they run when there's danger, and yet you still get, it's still shown in a way where you can see what's going on and tell what's going on and feel like you're there. Anyways, yeah. Now this one that he's doing now, I guess it's sort of like what his original idea for Day of the Dead was, which is that it would take place on like islands where like families run the island, and they even have subservient zombies. But there's like a Hatfield McCoy kind of feud between families. And one of them lets zombies live and use them as slaves, and the other one doesn't. And it's sort of like there's nothing that he's saying in these zombie movies now that he didn't say in the first three. And even like, I mean, Day of the Dead may not, you know, the superficial details may not be good, like the acting and some of the writing, but I mean, it sort of deals with the ideas of like, you know, what are zombies or whatever. I mean, it sounds kind of generic, but again, you got to remember that like in 85, zombies hadn't really been overexposed yet. In fact, not at all. Like this movie was only made 7 years after Dawn of the Dead, and it's like, I remember watching, you know, the scenes with Dr. Frankenstein talking about, like, you know, I finally figured this out, you know, here's why zombies are zombies. And I remember being, you know, really fascinated, like, oh, wow, this is like Romero giving, you know, an explanation as to what's happening, because since the first movie, Night and then in Dawn, there's no explanation for why people are coming back to life at all. So the exposition in this one is like the closest that you were gonna get, and it was cool.
Yeah,
zombies could still be objects of fear, and they were also still objects of mystery for not having been overexposed yet, which is why Bub was such a cool character.
Now in the newer ones, has he explained?
Oh well, in the new ones, like the newer ones, he doesn't explain anything. But what keeps happening is like the zombies just keep getting more intelligent. Like, in Land of the Dead, there's like a zombie revolutionary who winds up leading an army of fellow zombies to storm the city, the enclosed city for rich people, run by Dennis Hopper, while, you know, the poor people have to live outside the gilded city in shanty towns. It's like zombie. Really, really stupid zombie Bertolt Brecht or something. And Day of the Dead, you know, whatever. It's got all of Romero's, you know, social and political prejudices, but it's sort of attempting to grapple with some big ideas, is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Like, well, can't we all just get along, first of all, but also, you know, is what the doc, at least at the start of the movie, it's like, is the doctor really crazy, or is he on to something? Like, can zombies be domesticated? Because he sort of seems to know what he's talking about, because he's so enthusiastic. But then again, maybe not. But then by the end of the movie, you've got this intelligent zombie walking around, and it's it's cliche now to have intelligent zombies, but you know, when they first started showing up, it was like, wow, intelligent zombies. So.
Well, I remember, and this will be my final thing, is that I remember that somebody said this, that at the end of Dawn of the Dead, you see a zombie pick up a rifle and sort of look at it knowingly. Isn't that...
No, I think it's like looking down the barrel or something. It's not looking at it very knowingly.
Just that there was this idea that Romero was continuing these ideas, and the Dawn of the Dead did continue that idea, and it just it yeah. feels that...
Yeah, no, that's very true. Dawn of the Dead continued ideas from Night, and Day continues ideas from Dawn.
Right.
There's a progression, you know, not just in the logistical progression of the zombie situation has gotten even worse some undetermined period of time later. And then, and Land of the Dead even, you know, attempts to deteriorate the situation of the world even more from Day. But it's ridiculous because if things are as bad as they are in Day, then, you know, how did anyone ever get together to build a fortified city away from all the zombies and have, like, luxury class apartments inside? It's ludicrous, and he couldn't take it any further than that. So that's why Diary of the Dead takes place in modern times and starts with the beginning of the zombie epidemic.
And there's no reason to see it, right?
Nope. Not at all. Not unless you want to see John Leguizamo do a scene with Dennis Hopper where Leguizamo's a zombie. Leguizombie.
Okay, so I don't think we can really say much else, but I think what I would always say is start with Dawn of the Dead and then go back and then go forward.
Huh.
I know.
Why is that?
Because I think that Dawn of the Dead is...
the most accessible.
It's the most accessible. Yeah. Certainly right. Now that, you know, black and white is, you know, scaring people. And you had to remake Night of the Living Dead once in color, and then you colorized the original, and then you added the original colorized version, and I think they made a 3D version of it.
Well, that was another movie. It was just a 3D remake.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, wait, boy, we should watch that sometime.
Wait, they remade it again?
Yeah. That's supposed to be abominable.
No.
No, for real. Sid Haig's in it.
They remade it.
It's called, like, Night of the Living Dead 3D. Yeah.
It is. It's a remake. Oh, my God.
I kind of forgot about that myself.
That's so silly. Wow. Yeah, but, I mean, they did do a straight remake of it in 90, I remember. That
yeah,
Romero...
directed by Savini and written by Romero.
Yeah.
And that's pretty good, actually. It's not bad.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
Actually, I think it has kind of a similarity to Day of the Dead in that, one of the reasons I think this might be Savini's best work overall is that, like, unlike Dawn of the Dead, where he just had, like, hundreds of extras that he was slapping blue face paint on, like, in this one, there were a lot less extras, so he was sort of able to give some individual attention to each, like, zombie, even in the big crowd scenes at the end where they're all sort of coming into the underground hideout. Like, if you pause your movie and look at any one of the zombies, it's like they have their own unique, you know, facial disfigurations or whatever. So there's a lot of great individual attention to detail on every zombie. And I also like how their skin is kind of, like, grayish, you know, like it's lost all its blood and it's kind of crumbling away, but there aren't any zombies in here with, like, normal skin tones. They're all just they've been dead a long time, Barbara. They're horny. And they're all discolored. I was quoting Night of the Living Dead. I wasn't just saying that just to be saying it. I was saying that to make a reference.
But oddly, though, Night of the Living Dead might be the easiest way for people to start, since you can watch it legally online anywhere.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's been public domain for many, many years.
For some very silly reason.
Yep.
Yeah. Speaking of zombies, our next show we're going to watch, for our bad movie, we're going to watch Less Than Zero. And I believe Andrew McCarthy's performance in that is zombie-like.
Nice. We're also watching it because we've got Robert Downey Jr. fever with Iron Man 2 coming out. And he's in that.
Yeah.
And he's in Less Than Zero. So that's
and
our bad
he's
movie.
Doing heroin in Less Than Zero, and he used to do heroin in real life. Now he sells underwear to children. Sorry. Just, you know, it's kind of weird. But anyway.
Yeah, and our good movie is by John Cassavetes, whom I don't think we've seen any films from on the show before. And his movie that we're watching is The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, which is kind of like his... you know, thriller movie, like his genre movie, and he didn't really do genre movies. He did movies about relationships and husbands and wives and stuff, but this is a crime story, so it'll be fun.
Yeah, and we're watching that because Robert Downey Jr.'s not in it.
Yeah, that's the theme of next week is...
Movies with and without Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
And Jamie Gertz. I believe Jamie Gertz is the dramatic lead, female lead in Less Than Zero, which I've never seen it, so it's going to be something to look forward to.
Yeah, me either. Wasn't it written by Bret Easton Ellis?
It was, and the screenplay was written by Harley Payton, who I believe also wrote the Bruce Willis film Striking Distance.
Huh.
And I could be wrong about that. But yes, it's... notorious bomb, sort of at the end of the... There are no primary Brat Pack members.
The movie that killed the Brat Pack.
Well, on the other... It's all sub... It's all second-tier Brat Pack people, because Andrew McCarthy was in the... he was not first-tier Brat Pack, he was second-tier. He broke off on his own too soon. Yes. No, Harley Payton wrote... some Twin Peaks, and he wrote
that's
this.
What, yeah, I thought that sounded familiar.
And he wrote Moon Over Miami, which was a show with Bill Campbell from The Rocketeer. And then he's written some screenplays since then. The last thing he worked on was the Bruce Willis Bandits with Billy Bob Thornton. But yeah, so this has got... James Spader, Andrew McCarthy, Jamie Gertz, and Robert Downey Jr. are our primaries.
All right. Well, that's next week then, Less Than Zero and Killing of a Chinese Bookie. So check out our website, alansmithypodcast.info, for past episodes and the features of leaving comments. And I believe that's it. So for an Alan Smithy podcast, I've been Matt.
And I've been Andrew.
And thanks for listening.